All right, last week we looked at what we called proactive faith. And I'm going to summarize that because last week is the foundation for this week. And once we kind of review that, we'll move through this. But where we are in our study now, we're all the way to concept 30. Yes, we are making progress here. And this is the sixth week, I believe, week number six on faith. And we're strengthening the core of faith in our hearts. And we started with the righteous man lives by faith. Faith is our spiritual eyes. What the eyes are to the body is what faith is to the soul. Jesus became most exasperated with people who were of little faith. And there was a word in the New Testament for little faith. And naturally, if Jesus was not happy with little faith, his idea was for us to increase our faith or to grow. So we looked at that concept. Last week, we looked at proactive faith through a grid of the circle of concern and through the circle of influence and through the circle of what you can do to influence, circle of control. And tonight, we're going to look at responsible faith. And these two flow together. Let's just put these concepts together and you'll see how it works. Now, key verse that we've been working off of is Habakkuk 2:4, the righteous man shall live by faith. The righteous man shall stay alive by faith. Here we looked at last week the center, the circle of concern, circle of influence, and circle of control. The circle of concern refers to everything about life that is of concern to you, but things that you have no control over, like the federal deficit, like nuclear arms treaty, like the weather. These are things that affect you in control and to some degree are of concern to you, but you can't really do much about them one way or the other. All you can do is kind of go with the flow. The circle of influence is, The circle of influence are those things that you don't have primary responsibility for them. However, you have the ability to influence them to some degree. So you can invest some of yourself there and you can change things to a degree, but not ultimately. And then the third circle is the circle of control. And these are the things you have direct control over. And these are things that are assigned to you by the hand of God. They belong to you above anybody and anyone else. And this is where you should concentrate your energies is on what you can control and don't allow yourself to have valuable resources and energy siphon off in directions, the circle of influence and concern that you can't really control. So with the circle of influence, we are to have an observant faith. We observe how God is working life out around us and it's beyond us to influence it or control it. So we just observe it, but we trust that God is going to take care of things. The circle of influence, we have what's called an attentive faith. We pay attention to the things that we can influence, but we don't overly invest in those things because they ultimately are somebody else's choices. But the circle of control, we have an active faith, and these are things you do control. You do have direct influence over the outcome of those things, and so it makes sense to focus your energy there as opposed to the circle of influence and concern. You leave those things in the hand of God, like your children and your family and your job and the economy, and control what you can. All right? The righteous man shall live by faith. So in these different circles, we have a faith response, but it takes on a little bit of a different stance in one circle versus the other, just a way of conceptualizing it. Now, the reality lens we put up goes something like this. Your circle of concern are all the things that you can affect. Your circle of influence are all the things that can affect you. I'm sorry, I got it backwards. Circle of concern, all things that can affect you. Circle of influence, all things you can affect. Circle of control, all things you can direct. Those things that you can direct. We use the analogy, we have the circle of concern. All we can do is to react to those things going on around us. The circle of influence, we can interact. But in the circle of control, we can be proactive in that circle. We use the analogy of the circle of concern is like the fan who watches the football game. The circle of influence is like the coach who has some say about what goes on, but the circle of control is the player on the field and they directly affect the outcome of the game. So using an athletic analogy here in football season might help that make some sense to you. And the circle of concern, no matter how much energy we put into those, we get minimum results. the circle of influence, no matter how much we put into that circle of influence, we get mixed results. But the circle of control, whatever we pour into that in terms of energy, we get maximum results. So we want to put our energies where we're going to get the most results. And then the last column has to do with how we have a faith response to these different categories of reality. Circle of concern, observant faith. Not much we can do about it, we just observe it. Circle of influence, we pay attention to it. We can try to influence it, but ultimately somebody else's decision. Circle of control, we have an active faith. You can directly affect the outcome of this particular circle. So you ultimately trust it to God, but you do what you can to make what your part happen that God has given you in that role. Does that make sense? So some of you weren't here last week. Just make sure we recoup these insights and move through that. So last week we described proactive faith as distinguishing God's responsibility from mine in the affairs of everyday life and then responding wisely. And the point that I kind of left you with was, if you pour your energies into your circle of control, you tend to expand your circle of control that then shrinks the circle of influence and shrinks the circle of concern. However, if you put too much emphasis on circle of concern and influence, you shrink your circle of control to the point where you feel powerless and you will feel completely frustrated with the way life is going. So you have to set boundaries, you have to distinguish what's yours and what's not yours and determine how much energy you're going to pour into it accordingly. But where we should be putting the lion's share of our energy is a circle of control and keeping ourselves out of heavy investment outside of that. Otherwise, we just exasperate ourselves in that process. All right, now, point of discussion. All right, here we go. I'm going to give you all a case study tonight, and you all talk about this at your table. You are a counselor. A counselee comes to you and reports that he's angry at his boss. He relates that he always feels put down, and in spite of a satisfactory work performance, he never feels any appreciation. His attempts to speak with the boss are ignored, and he has given up on having any meaningful interaction with him. This counselee is engaged to be married and needs a job, can't not have a job. How would you counsel this frustrated man? At your tables? Pray, counselor, to this counselee. What would you tell him? This is where life is. Got to have a job. Can't change the job part necessarily. Or maybe you can. And maybe that's advice you're going to give him. I'll shut up. Y'all just play with it. All right. Y'all talk about it over there. I'll give you about 5 minutes. Y'all talk about it around your table. The card that's going around the room is for David Lufke, whose mother died. In case you didn't hear that. Y'all want to? Yeah. Anybody? Yes, sir. Go ahead. Don't let me interrupt you. Father. Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to table one up here. What counsel would you give him?
We said look at the brighter side of the positives instead of the negatives.
Okay.
See if you can change your view about it.
All right, change your view of the job.
Yeah.
All right, table two?
That was pretty much all.
Pretty much what he could control, go ahead and influence it. But if he wasn't in compliance with like the company view where he couldn't, look for somewhere where he would fit in better.
Okay.
Stress over that.
All right, that's good. Table three, what would you say? What's your advice?
What was it again?
We ran into that too.
Well, he's getting into, he's concerned about his boss, he's getting into circle of influence. He's trying to exert his influence over his boss, and his boss is not listening to him. So he's got to come back into his circle of control.
Yeah? Okay. Listen up.
A lot of joy will come out of the improvements he can make in his own circle of control.
All right.
You ought to look for another job.
Oh. Yeah. Change attitude and change circumstances. Hmm. So two layers, multiple level counsel here. What'd y'all come over with, table four?
Well, part of what we came up with was how do you define satisfaction?
Mm-hmm.
How do you define appreciation as far as the counselee is concerned?
Okay.
And then depending on the answer, of course, one could come back with, well, maybe the boss feels you are doing a good job because you are getting a satisfactory work is part of what the table says. There was another resounding theory at this table also.
What was that?
Get a grip.
Suck it up, huh? Oh, goodness. All right. All right. Let's try to break this down and we'll come back to a definitive answer, or at least try on it. Okay. Now, what we're going to talk about today is what determines how responsible are you for your response to life? What level of determinism do circumstances and people and things have over you? And those things have as much power as you choose to give them. So that's where we're gonna go. So let's kind of get into this because this is fascinating stuff. All right, now in terms of educated thought, there's different schools of or levels of determinism that we'll talk about. First of all, there is genetic determinism. That is, you inherited it from your family, so your grandparents did it to you. In other words, your grandparents made you the way that you are, and you can't fix it. You can't adjust it. You just, they're responsible for your basic makeup, and you just got to go with what you got. All right. Then there is the psychic determinism, which is you internalized it. That means your parents did it to you. They treated you a certain way, you internalized that, and it became a part of who you are and how you respond to life. So how you were impacted within your family system determines how you react to life around you. Your parents did it to you. Then there is environmental determinism, which means you inhaled it. That is, your boss did it to you. And whoever the boss was created an environment of criticism or being down on you, and you inhale that air, that smoke, and it began to stick to your ribs and stick to your lungs and affected the way you think about a situation. So these are all different ways of talking about what determines how we respond to life around us. And we tend to ascribe a certain amount of emphasis to these different things because they do impact our lives, but that's not really where we want to go. Now, I'm going to give you a theory here that is infinitely liberating. And I heard it when I was an intern in a church in South Florida. And this is one of those concepts you hear and you just don't ever forget. Or at least I didn't. So may not be the same for you, but we'll see how that goes. Now, let's start with a stimulus. A stimulus is an event or a circumstance that happens around you. We're just going to use the technical psychological word stimulus for that. Something happens around you. And then there is your response to the stimulus. How do you feel about that circumstance? Or how do you feel about that event? Okay? So it's kind of like here you got a counselor coming to you saying, I'm miserable on my job. That's an event. And he's describing his response to the event. Well, what is it about the job that's making you miserable? Well, I have an oppressive, unreasonable, unapproachable, negative boss. And so I don't feel appreciated. I don't feel like the work that I'm doing is ever good enough, et cetera, et cetera. And it's causing me to think negatively toward myself. So therefore, I'm mad at the world about this thing. So stimulus or event is called A. Everybody follow along? Can we see it? Stimulus is called A. Response is called C. Now what's in between? What's come between A and C?
B.
So what is B? What really determines your response? Is it the stimulus or the event? Or is there something between your response to the event and the event itself? What's the B that goes between the A and the C?
Your interpretation.
Okay, yeah, it's your freedom to choose how to respond to the event. And what determines how you respond is, as you said, Ed, how you choose to interpret it. It's the interpretation you ascribe to it that affects your response. Let me tell you a story that will illustrate the point to some degree. There was I read a story one time about a man who was on an airplane. And sitting up in the front of the plane where he was a man holding his little boy. And the little boy screamed the entire plane flight, "Daddy, I want to go sit in back with Mommy." And Dad said, "You can't go sit in back with Mommy. You're staying up here with me." And so this child disrupts the entire flight. And everybody's sitting there thinking, would you just let the kid go sit in the back of the plane with his mother? Right? That's the logical interpretation. But toward the end of the flight, the father of the child explained to the passengers nearby that the child's mother had just died. And that the mother was in a casket in the cargo portion of the plane. And so Mommy was in back of the plane. Mommy was with them on the plane, but he couldn't go back. The child couldn't go back to Mommy. Now, initially, all the passengers surrounding this event were angry that the dad wouldn't let the child go sit in the back with Mom until they understood what was really happening. And when they understood that this was a very tragic situation with a deceased mother and the child couldn't go back, the dad had no choice but to keep the child with him. Then how do you think all the passengers around the disrupting influence felt? Like complete heels. Now what happened? The event was the same. You have a child screaming to go back to the plane to be with Mom. But their understanding and their interpretation of the event changed when they understood the circumstances, when they understood B. That changed their response to the child crying to go back to be with Mom. So here's what you got to understand, is that there are events in life, and then there's your response to it, but there's something in between that you have control over. We just don't often realize it. We have the power to interpret things certain ways. Now, table one up here said that when you're counseling the guy who doesn't like the job, change your attitude. Change how you're interpreting the job situation. Don't think of it the way you're thinking of it. Think of it differently. Now, this table said, go get a different job, maybe. In other words, response or C is negative. Change A. Change the event. Now, sometimes if the job really gets bad, you have to change the event, sometimes, but not always. Not always what's involved initially is changing the way you're interpreting the event and seeing the event, and this is where as believers, this is where it gets real exciting. The possibilities get real exciting for us, because what enables us to reinterpret events is that we can see them by faith through God's eyes. And that when you exercise your freedom to choose to see things through God's eyes and not through the heart, your own heart response to circumstances, when you take an inverted view of it, it tends to change the way you think about it. Does that make sense? Is everybody following with me here? Because there's a power that we have that it's God-given. We didn't create this power. We don't assume it. It's given to us by God. We have the power to interpret what's happening around us. We have that power. You know what happens a lot of times? We choose not to exercise the power. Or we wrongly exercise the power in such a way that we give a stimulus, event, circumstances, way too much control over our response to life. We let our circumstances define us. And what you're doing is over-empowering your circumstances when you do that. We all do it. We all do it. This is a really hard thing. And like I said, I first learned this when I was an intern back in the 70s, and I'm still trying to figure this thing out. Still trying to get a handle on it in my own life. So this is not some, you're not going to hear this tonight, walk out of here and be suddenly on top of the world. Don't expect that. I mean, this is going to hit you on the core level of your assumptions about life. And you're going to have to take some time and prayerfully process this. So let's try to take this concept tonight. It's called the ABC theory. A does not equal C. A does not equal C. Events do not determine your response to life. They do not. We tend to think that they do. We've over-empowered A. We've given A too much power over C. In between your ability to interpret, in between your experience of life and the circumstances of life and your response to it, lies the power to choose, which influences dramatically your response to life. Okay, now, we're going to do a case study. And the details of this case study are in your notes because I wanted you to have this. And I'm going to read it out loud so it'll be on tape up here. But this really began to come into focus through the life experience of a man in a Nazi concentration camp, in which all the normal liberties of life and comforts of life were completely taken away from him. And under those circumstances, most people give up, quit, and die. And a lot of people died in those concentration camps because of broken hearts, and they lost the will to live. But listen to this story and watch how this person discovered a power he didn't know he had. And that was the power to choose to interpret these events in such a way that he was able to stay alive and live to tell about it. Here's how the story goes. Let me share with you the catalytic story of Viktor Frankl. Frankl was a determinist. Remember, we talked about that just a minute ago. Raised in the traditional Freudian psychology, which postulates or believes that whatever happens to you as a child shapes your character and personality and basically governs your whole life. The limits and parameters of your life are set, and basically you can't do much about it. In other words, your context growing up determines your response to life, and you're on the hook. You're stuck, you can't change it. That's what determinism believes. Frankl was a psychiatrist who adhered to that school of determinism, and he was a Jew. He was imprisoned in death camps of Nazi Germany, where he experienced things that were so repugnant to our sense of decency that we shudder to even repeat them. His parents, his brother, and his wife died in the camps or were sent to the gas ovens. Except for his sister, his entire family perished. Frankl himself suffered torture and innumerable indignities, never knowing from one moment to the next if his path would lead to the ovens or if he would be among the saved who would remove the bodies or shovel out the ashes of those so fated. One day, naked and alone in a small room, he began to become aware of what he later called the last of human freedoms. The freedom his Nazi captors could not take away. They could control his environment. They could do what they wanted to do to his body. But Viktor Frankl himself was a self-aware being who could look as an observer at his very involvement in those circumstances. His basic identity was intact. He could decide within himself how all of this was going to affect him. Between what happened to him, or the stimulus, and his response to it, was the freedom and the power to choose that response. In the midst of his experiences, Frankl would project himself into different circumstances, such as lecturing to his students after his release from the death camps. He could describe himself in the classroom, in his mind's eye, giving his students the lessons he was learning during his very torture. Through a series of disciplines, mental, emotional, and moral, principally using memory and imagination, which is another word for fantasy, he exercised his small embryonic freedom until it grew larger and larger, until he had more freedom than even his Nazi captors. They had liberty, more options to choose from their environment, but he had freedom, more internal power to exercise his options. He became an inspiration to those around him, even to some of the guards. He helped others find meaning in their suffering and dignity in their prison existence. In the midst of the most degrading circumstances imaginable, Frankl used the human endowment of self-awareness to discover a fundamental principle about the nature of man. Between stimulus and response, man has the freedom to choose. Now, he's written a book called, I think it's called The Meaning of Life. And you can get a fuller, detailed outlay of what he wrote about. And this book is still studied in psychiatric schools and so forth. And it has great value. Now, I remember, no one would argue that the death camp circumstances were about as miserable as they could be. I was recently watching a World War II documentary, and it got to the end of World War II when the Americans had entered Germany, and they walked into these cities where they had these concentration camps in gas chambers going, and the citizens were living within 100 yards of these things and didn't know what was happening. And they walked into this stuff and found these people. And there was this one American soldier that he was just narrating the experience of walking into this camp and finding all of this horror. And he looked into the camera with this distant look in his eyes, and he says, "No amount of human apology will ever suffice for what they did to those people." I mean, it was just awful. And in that set of circumstances, where you don't even have clothes on your back, Frankl discovered, I got a choice. I can choose to empower these circumstances and let them determine my response, or I can choose to disempower these circumstances and exercise my freedom to view myself as an intact, okay person, and these are the people with the problems. And it enabled him to survive, and he lived to tell about it. Where so many of them would run to the electrical fences, electrically charged fences, and just fry themselves. They just couldn't take it anymore. And after a while, they were so overwhelmed, most of the people, that they died not just from emaciated bodies, which they certainly had, but far worse, but really from attitude. So in that set of circumstances, he learned the power of choice. Now, when it comes to hardship in life, we Americans are very pleasure, entertainment-oriented, and we have this assumption that life owes us a good time. We really do believe that. So when life gets hard and confusing and uncertain and difficult, we get mad. We get mad. And we stop looking at our circumstances interpretively. And it's that point that we give up power. Enormous power that God has given to us. We give it up. We yield it. We don't use it. We just ignore it. And we just let life circumstances dictate who we are. And that's not God's highest and best for us. So as we were talking last week about looking through reality, looking at reality through the lens of what's of concern to you, what you can influence, and what you can control. You have to see life through that grid. But then also what you have to begin to do if you're going to live life in the way God wants you to live it, you have to learn to exercise individual personal power to interpret what's happening to you through God's eyes. You have to begin to do that. That's why God throws us fastballs and curveballs. And if He let our lives be comfortable all the time, we would never learn to exercise this power. We would not learn to do it because we wouldn't be forced to do it. We would just be fat and happy. It's like Solomon, who lived all of his life with very few trials and ended up a train wreck. His life was a train wreck at the end. And I told you all the story about the woman. I did her husband's funeral after some of the workers in his company came over and cut his throat in his own home, and she was there. And I remember doing the funeral out in the sticks 30 miles from Tampa so the press wouldn't find out about it. And I remember looking at her, and she had this kind of radiant look on her face during the funeral, and I'm thinking, I just don't get this. I don't know how she's able to radiate that spirit. And she told me afterwards, she said, James, this is not the first husband I've lost. This is my second one I've lost. And the pastor who did my first husband's funeral said to me, the only place where the sun shines all the time is the desert. You want to live in a desert all the time? Now, again, I'm not trying to be smart-alecky about this, but I'm just saying we tend to idolize living in the sunshine all the time, but what you're going to end up with is a disempowered person who doesn't really have the discipline to manage the hard things of life. So this is why God takes us through the undulations of trials as we go through. Now, let's leave the case study behind now. Let's keep our little ABC theory in front of us. There's a stimulus, an event, a circumstance. There's your response to it over here. But in between, you have power. Take hold of the power that God has given you. Let's talk about that power, because that's what the Bible says. All right, now, first of all, I need to teach you a vocabulary. There's a vocabulary that you've got to learn to enter into this way of thought. You got to kind of get this. First of all, the word, we've already talked about a lot of this. An event, the word event means a life circumstance occurs around you. Something happens around you. We'll call it an event. It's a life circumstance. Secondly, your response is how you feel about the event. Now, it's not only your feelings, but it involves your feelings. Our emotions tend to be our reactions to things, how we react to things. So our response is, generally speaking, how do you feel about that particular event? The evaluation is how you interpret the event. And that's in between the event and how you feel about it. The mind is that aspect of human nature that contains a reservoir of beliefs about life. And it's the mind that contains certain assumptions that dictates how we interpret things. How we interpret things is driven by the assumptions we embrace with our minds. So the mind is that reasoning process by which we believe certain things. The old man is your old sin nature or your flesh. And there's a whole bunch of lies in that old man that Satan has put there that have thoroughly confused us and taught us that life is all about us, that life owes us, and that we have a right to expect life to be good. Those are all lies that are running around in the old side of the old man, and they dictate the way we interpret things. The new man is the redeemed nature that God gives us once we become Christians. And that new man is separated from that old man and all those old lies. And the old man in the Bible is called the flesh. The new man is called the spirit. Okay? The heart is the seat of our being, which contains our life intentions, from which we choose our life direction. The mind kind of gives us life assumptions, but the heart is concerned with us pursuing directions that are good for us, okay for us, and not bad for us. So your heart drives, it's the seat of the human being that drives you forward, and inside of your heart is this set of convictions and beliefs about life that here's what I need to do for my needs to be taken care of. The heart drives that. And then the self is that primary reference point for life. In other words, when you see reality around you, it's jaded by your perspective because you see it from your perspective only. I mean, think about it. That's the only perspective you can see it from. So yourself is your primary point of reference when you're left to yourself to figure out how to respond to what's going on around you. That's all you have. And what begins to happen is when faith comes into our hearts, faith is the means that shifts our primary reference point away from ourselves to God. Faith is what liberates us from being in bondage to interpreting everything from my own sweet little point of view. There are realities that are much, much, much beyond us that are happening. It's like I heard Yusuf say in a sermon one time, God is at work on 1,000 fronts at once. We only see one front, our little front. We don't see what He's doing in a bigger perspective. And so our thinking is just too limited, but it's faith that lifts you up out of that, that breaks the power of that bondage. It allows you to see it from God's point of view. Now, we can't see everybody's perspective, but God can. And when we see it through God's point of view, that has an incredibly empowering effect upon the way we view things. It just changes everything. So this is where faith changes everything around. Now, we're going to take this vocabulary, and you're generally familiar with this, and we're going to put this into a diagram now and show you how it kind of all works and how it drives you in the way you make your way through life. So let's put these pieces together. This is an exotic diagram that we have this exotic zoom in on, and hopefully it'll make some sense to you. Okay, now how does faith liberate? How does faith liberate you from this disempowered perspective that you're a victim to everything going on around you? All right, now let's picture that this little circle up here is a human head. And that little window in there is your mind and the way you think about things. And this will all make sense in just a minute. All right, now, outside of you, there is an event. An event occurs. Okay? So your mind is, that represents you. Outside of you, an event happens. Okay? Now, what happens between you and your event is an evaluation process takes place. An interpretive process comes into play. It is triggered when something happens around you. You get up, you walk outside your house in the morning, you look outside, and it's dreary, rainy, like it has been the last 10 days. How do you feel about that? After the last 10 days, you're thinking, enough, no more rain, please. Or you walk outside and it's just sunny, 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 and you feel all brightened up about that. So this is how it happens. Here, there's a response inside of you. There's an event outside of you. But then in between that is your interpretation of it. Now, let's keep going. Satan is in the picture. The Bible speaks of the mystery of iniquity and Satan kind of working in a spiritual, mysterious way that we can't always understand. But he's in there. And the world and wrong programming are affecting the way they're giving us certain assumptions about life that affects the way we evaluate things. So the only way to learn to change that evaluation process is that we have to break the power of these worldly, satanic, devilish views that are not true, not truthful, and they're confusing. All right. So that reservoir and the lower half of that square inside of your head are all those beliefs and ideas that the world and Satan train you to think wrongly about. So all that's below the surface, but it's affecting the way you interpret things. Now, let's keep going. This little air refers to the heart. And the heart, like we said, is that part of you that determines life direction. And our life direction is determined based upon what's good for us. That's how we look at the world around us. And the heart is contains all those life processes whereby we decide which direction we're going to take. And the basic direction drives in and takes us in the direction of what's good for ourselves. Now, this is, we're through kind of the first half of the diagram. And this is what your life and mine looked like when we were lost. This is kind of all we had. We had a mindset that interpreted things around us, events around us, circumstances around us, on the basis of a set of assumptions that were satanic and worldly and ungodly, apart from God. And those things in the old man drove us toward what we thought was right for us. And so life ultimately was about us. It was about us. You see, when you're a parent, your children are free to focus all of their energy on themselves, because that's all they have to think about. You're an adult. You've got to go to work. You got to put on clothes. You've got to wash clothes. You've got to run a household. You've got to do all these different things. And you've got a multiple of an array of responsibilities you got to think about. Children are free to think about themselves and nothing more, because you're taking care of them. So this is why children can sometimes drive you nuts, because they can focus their energies on themselves. And we've got to be careful not to let them, in the pursuit of themselves, overpower what's right. So we have to challenge that. That's called discipline. And the Bible has a lot to say about that, and it's not our purpose tonight to talk about that. But anyway, I'm just injecting that. Now, we become Christians, all right? Here's the old man, and we're trapped in this mindset that's causing us to think of ourselves as victims of circumstances around us all the time. And then suddenly God intervenes, takes hold of our lives, enters us through the presence of His Spirit, and all of a sudden things now are about to change. They're about to change. Now watch how this works out. We suddenly acquire a new set of eyes. We look at things differently now because we have God in our lives. We can actually see things through a godly or a divine perspective, and that starts to change our assumptions about life. Because now we're not looking at life, evaluating it simply in terms of self, but now we're seeing it from a much broader, bigger, wiser, larger, comprehensive perspective. It's called faith, and we're putting our faith in this person named Jesus, who reveals Himself to us as not only the Son of God, but God the Son. And Jesus comes to reveal to us the heart of the Father. So as we put our faith in Jesus, and we start looking to Jesus, who is the embodiment of God in the flesh, while He was here upon the earth, and we can relate to Him who is our mediator between us and God, now we start to see things from a whole different perspective. Now the world of old man assumptions changes. And we've also got this book called the Bible, that we don't grow up with an innate knowledge of the Bible. We have to be taught it. That's why you give up your Thursday nights or your Sunday nights or your Sunday afternoons, and you come out here and you listen to me, so that I can help you understand these things. This is why you get to church on Sunday morning. You go to places where the Bible is going to be taught, because you need to download truth into your heart and into your mind on a constant basis to displace all that old man stuff that you're trying to get out from under. And what this does is it creates now a new man, old man tension, so that what you've got is a counter to the old man and the old man's way of thinking. You now got a whole new point of reference that begins to create within you this new person, so that you start to respond differently to the pressures of life. For instance, when you're a non-Christian, something bad happens, somebody pulls in front of you while you're hurrying to get to work, they pull in front of you, slow you down, you flip them off. You get angry and you flip them off, or you make a dirty face or what have you. You become a Christian, you're on your way to work. Somebody pulls in front of you. You think to yourself, that car pulled in front of me because God wants that car in front of me, and He's trying to slow me down right now so that I don't rush through this thing and get into an accident. Changes your whole perspective. Now, I know that's a simplified perspective, but you get it. You see how it happens. So faith ignites a whole new way of looking at things. And so the old man is being subdued and replaced, and we've got a new man that's emerging in its place. Now, between now and the day you die, that old man is never going to go away. There are some counseling systems today, and there are some theological systems that believe that when you become a Christian, the old man is dead. That is biblical error. Don't ever believe that. If you believe that, you're setting yourself up to getting bushwhacked at the pass. That is a serious miscalculation. I mean serious. Pardon? Yeah, it's in there. But when you run across the language, it talks about the old man being dead. It's talking positionally, not conditionally. And that's where, when that distinction's not made, you've got well-intending, Bible-believing Christians misinterpreting the Bible. There's a difference between position and condition. Positionally before God, yeah, that old man's dead. God doesn't even see it anymore. He's forgiven you. It's all washed clean. The blood of Jesus has covered it. But conditionally, he's still in there going hard at it. And it's the new man against the old man. Starve the old man, feed the new man. And eventually the new man overcomes it. Read Romans 7, where Paul says, the things I want to do, I can't do. I really want to do the right thing, but I just can't do it. What's wrong with me? It's because that old man has not gone away. He's rearing his ugly head. And all the verbs in Romans 7 are present tense. He's not. Some people say, well, he's talking before he became a Christian. Really? Why is he using present tense verbs? If he's using present tense verbs, he doesn't say, it used to be that when I didn't, that I want to do the right thing, I couldn't. But he's using a present tense language that suggests a present tense struggle. But anyway, that's a bunch of theology. It's a theological perspective we don't have time to debate tonight. What I want you to get is, here's your picture, guys, and in between you and an event is the power to evaluate. The new man tries, hopes, prays to see it through God's perspective. The old man sees it through your selfish perspective. If you look at it through the old man's eyes with those worldly assumptions, you're going to get mad, frustrated, angry. If you see it through God's eyes, you're going to recognize that God is at work on 1,000 fronts. God is sovereign. He's in control. He's got your circle of concern totally under control. You're resting in that, and it's all going to take care of itself. And peace begins to come into your heart like a river. And strength, because you're exercising your power to interpret things through God's eyes. That is your power. Don't give it up. Don't ignore that. Don't let Satan have that, or he'll eat your lunch. He'll make you miserable. He will heap upon you all kinds of hot coals of misery and pain if you let him. If you're seeing things through, wow, this is a hassle in my life. This is making me miserable. Yeah, this is how you want to view it. All these things are happening in the providence of God, and I'm going to trust him. So you got to get out from underwater. You got to flip it. You got to right side up it is what you have to do. And this is how God begins to work in our hearts and in our lives. And this is a process that will begin early in your journey and will be with you until God takes you home. You won't be delivered from this thing until the day that God takes you out of here. And what we can do in the process is learn to exercise that power. Viktor Frankl finds himself in this miserable set of horrendous circumstances, naked, alone in a room where everything of any semblance of dignity is gone. And he says, whoops, wait a minute, I got one thing left. I've got the power to choose how I respond to this. Now that's coming from a Jew who's not a believer. That's not coming from a regenerated new man nature there. That's the challenging thing about that story. Pardon?
I mean, wasn't that also Paul's response when he was in prison?
Yeah, we're going to look at it. Absolutely. Yeah, now let's put this to work here, guys. Let's go into the Bible and you'll see what I'm talking about as we get into perspective. All right, let's look at some verses. Okay, in Ephesians chapter 4, Paul talks about laying aside the old man and putting on the new man. Anybody need a Bible? Vicky's handing them out. All right, Ephesians chapter 4, this is about verse 22, I think. It says, "So this I say, affirm together with the Lord that you walk no longer as the Gentiles walk, in the futility of their mind, being darkened in their understanding, excluded from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the hardness of their heart. They, having become callous, have given themselves over to sensuality for the practice of every kind of impurity with greediness." Now, this is how you used to live. This is when the old man had power over your life. This is what your life looked like. You were walking around in the futility of your mind, darkened in your understanding, separate from God, and pursuing what made sense to you and what felt good to you. So you were pursuing, you were giving yourselves over to the pursuit of greed and impurity and what have you, because it made you feel good. And Paul says, that's how you used to be. Walk no longer in that way. And then this is what he tells us. But you didn't learn Christ this way, if indeed you have heard Him and have been taught in Him, just as truth is in Jesus, that in reference to your former manner of life, lay aside the old self, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lusts of deceit, and that you be renewed in the spirit of your mind and put on the new self, which is the likeness of God, which in the likeness of God has been created in righteousness and holiness of truth. And notice the contrast between this description of the Gentiles, lost people when they were in the futility of their mind, darkened in their understanding, they were ignorant, excluded from the life of God, their hearts were hardened. And now over here what he says is, lay aside that old man, put on the new. And you do that by being renewed in the spirit of your mind, and you put on the new self, which in the likeness of God has been created in righteousness, holiness, in truth. No longer lies, but truth. You're now delivered from the power of error and untruth. Now you have the power of truth. There's nothing stronger, more liberating than the power of truth. Jesus said, you'll know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Get the picture? So as we start looking at life through truth, a truthful perspective, we're set free. We're liberated. That's the pathway to freedom. That's what he's saying. Let's keep going. Romans 12, 2. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. It's putting truth. The Greek word for the word mind is the word nous. And there's a Christian counselor named Leah Crabb who famously says, put truths in your noose. It rhymes. You know, let it play. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Put truths in your noose. Truth in your mind. James 1, 2, and 3. Now, this is why you come to this verse and you think, what in the world is he talking about here? Count it all joy when you encounter trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. So our assumption, our perspective, our evaluation, John, of trials is to count it all joy. Why should we count hardship joy? Because of the ultimate impact it has on your growth as a person. So the Bible says through many tribulations you'll enter the kingdom of God. It doesn't say if, it says when. When you encounter tribulations, we know they're coming. We're uphill people in a downhill world. We're saved people in a fallen world. Expect hardship. That's the expectation we should operate from, not the expectation that life owes us. Because all that's going to do is rob us of joy and peace. Learn tolerance for hardship, because that's part of living. We're uphill people in a downhill world. It's going to come. And when I go through periods of quietness and things seem to be good, occasionally I'll say to Cindy, you know, we hadn't been through any hardship in a while. I'm wondering what's coming. And she'll say, don't say that. Stop. You're going to speak it into existence. And I'm like, well, I'm not worried about that, hon. But yeah, I shouldn't be sitting here waiting for it to hit me. But you're going to have to develop a sense of God gives you wide places in the road, and then you're going to hit the valleys. And you're going to get through the valleys, and then you're going to have to climb mountains. And then sometimes when you get to the mountains, you'll get down on the plains, and He'll let you go for a while. And so it just undulates and moves it around, but it's all God's different way of bringing pressures into your life to develop the power he wants you to have to choose the right way to think about it and develop your muscles of character. That's what he's doing redemptively in your life. That's why we encounter trials with joyfulness. But Jesus says, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. What? Why would I do that? They hit me, I'll hit back. They shoot at me, I'll shoot back. Why not? Eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. That's what the Pharisees said. Jesus said, absolutely not. Change the way you think about this. When you hate somebody back who hates you, you're giving hatred power in your life. Never do that. Never. Human nature doesn't function through hatred and anger. We function through love and concern and gentleness. That's the fuel that human nature lives by. And you don't let somebody duplicate their anger and their rage and their bitterness in you. And when you respond in kind to hateful people, you're just letting, it's like pouring sand in your own gas tank. And that's what you're doing. Or when you choose to get bitter towards somebody, it's like hoping somebody dies, but you drink the poison. That's what it is. So Jesus says, don't let yourself get underneath that. Somebody hates, is hateful to you, love them back. Return good for evil. You overpower that. It sets you free. In Romans 8:35, what shall separate us from the love of Christ? So tribulation, distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword, those are some really bad things. That's what Viktor Frankl went through when he was in the concentration camps. Nakedness, power, peril, and sword. That's what he was in. But the Bible says in all these things, we overwhelmingly conquer. So we're not victims, but we're victors. You've heard that language distinction. We're not victims, we're victors. But we can let ourselves drift into the victim mentality. It can take hold. And it drives us into self-pity and anger and frustration. Examples. In Philippians 1:26, the Apostle Paul is in prison. Now, Paul's the most powerful evangelist, prophet, man of his day. He is just the gospel in action. And he goes through two imprisonments. The first one was 2 years. The second was 4 years. So in Paul's 30-year public ministry, he spent about 15% of it in jail. You think that's fun? And in prisons back in those days, we didn't have fairness and equity. You may never get out of prison in those days. They'll stick you in a cell and let you rot. You didn't have any idea when you were going to get out. They were under the oppression of the Roman authorities, and they didn't care about the Jews. They didn't care about anybody that hassled them. They'll throw you in jail and let you die there. But Paul is in jail, and listen to what he says in Philippians chapter 1. Now, I want you to know, brethren, that my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel, so that my imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard. Look how God is at work through this imprisonment. It's become known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to everyone else, and that most of the brethren, trusting the Lord because of my imprisonment, have far more courage to speak the word of God without fear. This imprisonment has ignited boldness in the lives of a lot of Christians, so that now they're willing to defy the authorities of that day, speak about Christ, and if they get thrown in jail, then so did Paul, so throw me in jail. I mean, they were living in, this was an instance of civil disobedience here. Notice what he says. He goes on to say, some to be sure are preaching Christ even from envy and strife, but some also from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. Now he's acknowledging here, some people are preaching the gospel with wrong motives. So they're advancing the gospel inappropriately. Doesn't matter. Why? Because the gospel is advancing. Whether people have the wrong motives or not, doesn't matter if the gospel is being lifted up. So he's choosing to reinterpret these really, really exasperating circumstances in such a way that he sees God at work and he's moving through it. That's what God gives us the power to do. Here's another incident. In Acts 16, I love this passage. This is where Paul was in the city of Philippi and got thrown into jail, he and Silas. And it says, when they had struck them with many blows, even though they had not done anything wrong, they threw them into prison, commanding the jailer to guard them securely. And he, having received such a command, threw them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks. That's a pretty miserable experience. That's a pretty disempowering experience to have your feet locked into these wooden stocks and you can't move. What happens when you have to go to the bathroom? I don't know. But about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns of praise to God. Hello. It wasn't like Paul and Silas were around midnight licking their wounds of self-pity and thinking, how did we get here? If God really cared about us, why'd He let this happen? But it says they're in prison with their feet in stocks singing hymns of praise to God. And it says, hymns of praise. I thought the word thanksgiving was in there, but I don't see it. And the prisoners were listening to them. And then what happens is an earthquake occurs. All the prisoners are set free from the prison. The Philippian jailer is converted and God does a mighty work. So God takes these circumstances, works through them, and Paul's in step with what God is doing, not what he wants and what he feels. I love this story. Here, these two stories are good examples of this story. A pastor once asked a member of his congregation, so how you doing? And the guy says, well, under the circumstances. And the pastor says, well, what are you doing under there? what are you doing under your circumstances? You're not supposed to be under there. You're a Christian. You're a believer. You've got faith. You're like a cork. You're not like a piece of lead. Lead sinks to the bottom. Corks sink to the top. And that's what we as Christians are. We're not balloons that have air in them, because balloons with air in them sink to the ground. Balloons with helium in them soar up in the air. And when the Spirit of God comes inside of us, that lifts us up. And we rise above things, not below them. Now, again, there are times when this is a long, hard struggle. But ultimately, you're going to win it. You're in it to win it. God is in it to win it. He's going to get you where He wants you to be. So we have to exercise that power we've got. A couple of quotes. Between event, stimulus, and response, man has the freedom to choose. You've got the freedom to choose your response to a circumstance. He is most powerful who has power over himself. Now, that's probably a humanistic statement, but the statement recognizes that we all have power to choose. No one can deny you the power to choose your response to a set of circumstances. No one can take that away from you. No matter whether they flog you, beat you, poison you, starve you, or crucify you, you still have the power to choose. And that's how I take the quote. Another quote, the fountain, look at this, this is really good. The fountain of content must spring up in the mind, and he who has so little knowledge of human nature as to seek happiness by changing anything but his own disposition will waste his life in fruitless efforts and multiply the grief he proposes to remedy. Somebody with a lot of wisdom and insight made that observation. Samuel Johnson's his name, whatever that is. All right, gut check. To what degree are you responsible for your reactions in life? That's what we're trying to answer here. Remember the guy who's miserable at work and his boss doesn't like him? The boss is making life miserable on him. What is the first thing that he should do? Learn to interpret the event through God's eyes. Now, he may need to change jobs eventually. That could happen. And sometimes we do change jobs. Sometimes we do change circumstances. But the initial response to a set of circumstances is always, okay, God, what are you up to here? Help me see this from your point of view. Help me in my unbelief, which is what we talked about a couple of weeks ago. All right? The Bible states that man is a responsible moral agent. Romans 14:12 says, each man will give an account of himself to God. That means we're going to be responsible for the way we respond to life. Now notice this, please. Everybody listening, drum roll, please. The word responsibility means response-ability. Responsibility means the ability to choose your response. When we say, are you responsible, or you are responsible for, that means you have the ability to determine your response to things. That's what being responsible is. That's what the word technically means. The ability to choose our response. So responsibility is a responsibility. Don't let anybody take that freedom away from you. That is your God-given freedom. Empowered, proactive people recognize this and live their lives making choices based upon truth through faith, not feelings. Not feelings. Feelings are the caboose on the train, not the engine. In the American culture, we tend to make feelings the engine, and faith or fact rather the caboose. But it's fact, and then faith, and then feelings is the way it should go. Faith is the game changer when it comes to attitude. It enables a person to evaluate events from God's perspective and then with God's help, choose to respond in a godly way. That's our responsibility. So when we talk about responsible faith, let me get through this. We've gone over time. All right. In a certain circumstance, what should you do? Concentrate first on your response, not the circumstances. Concentrate on your response, not the circumstances initially. Asking God to help you by faith to see things through His eyes. By concentrating on your response, you gradually expand your circle of control. In other words, you begin to affect the circumstances around you proactively. Example in 1 Peter 3:1 and 2, how do believing wives interact with their unbelieving husband? It says, do it lovingly, gently, and kindly. And it says, your gracious behavior will win them to the Lord. So when we respond to things by faith, seeing them through God's eyes, we trust what somebody else's choices are. We entrust that to God. We don't try to change their choices or take over their will. The winsome wife wins the husband. The contentious wife runs him off or undermines what God may be doing in his life. That's the principle behind 1 Peter 3:1 and 2. By concentrating on being, we get out from under the tyranny of having. Now think of this real quickly, and I'll run through this. We think to ourselves, if I just had a little more money, that'd be a game changer. Well, the Bible says, let's have a little bit more contentment. Instead of having, being is what we're after. We say, if I just had more obedient kids. Well, how about if you say, God, give me more patience with my kids. Having versus being. If I had an understanding spouse, God, give me the grace to be understanding. Let me be an understanding spouse to them. If I just had more time, let me learn to be in the moment. Let me learn to be. It's being versus having. The having mindset says, life owes me. If I just had this, I'd be a perfectly content, happy person. That's not really the way God thinks about things. The way He thinks about things is, learn to be what I've called you to be, no matter what the circumstances are. Focus on being, not having. The having thing is going to get you into the self-pity spiral. Happens to us all the time. And here's the advice that I think about. I think to myself whenever I'm in a situation I don't like. Be the change you want to see in others. Be the change you want to see in others. If you want to see somebody else be more self-controlled, then you be self-controlled. You want to see somebody be more loving, you be loving. Model that first, and then you've got the right to confront their lack of it. But until you can model it, you can't really say anything. You can't really condemn in others what you are guilty of yourself. That will not be received. The other person is not going to hear you. All right, here's concept 30. We've said a mouthful tonight. We're almost done here. Responsible faith is exercising the empowerment God has given me to respond to the circumstances of everyday life in an overcoming way that honors Him, blesses me, and enables me to be a blessing to others. When people realize they have this power, and they're able to manage their responses to life around them, they become an enormous blessing to people because they're relaxed in the midst of pain. They're relaxed in the midst of challenge. And we love that and we respect that when we see that in people. What we don't respect is when we see us responding in a self-piteous way or an angry way. We tend to disrespect that. But when we see people managing hardship, we really go out to that. I saw a video this past week of a guy who was in a skiing accident, paralyzed from the shoulders down. And he was saying, look, I there's nothing I can do about my circumstances. We just got to go on with life. And his attitude was so completely admirable. I just sat there watching this guy thinking, oh, that I could handle that like that. I probably wouldn't. I probably wouldn't have responded that way. I know I wouldn't have. But anyway, when you see it in somebody else, when we model godliness, it makes a huge difference. All right, next week. We have 2 weeks left on the faith concept. Next week is faith that works. Faith brings power into our lives. And it enables God to do powerful things through us. And we're going to look at this next week. And then the last week, we're going to look at enduring faith. The Bible has 6 different words to describe those who veer away from the faith in shipwreck. We're going to look at those words where it talks about pressing on. Don't get discouraged and give up. All right, you guys have been a great audience. I've talked a long time tonight. Hang in there, and we'll see you next Sunday night.